You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line, with a resounding victory, President-elect Barack Hussein Obama made history on the evening of November 4th, 2008, running on the slogan, Change You Can Believe In. Many are hoping that after 8 long years of the Bush administration, change has arrived. But what about change for the Palestinians and their untenable situation? What change can he bring for the world's oldest refugee population? We'll speak to Kathleen and Bill Christensen, both formerly with the CIA, about this issue. Also this week, almost immediately after securing the presidency, Obama picked Rahm Emanuel, a staunch supporter of Israel, as his White House chief of staff. How will this appointment affect the so-called change that Obama campaigned on, and in particular, how will it affect the Palestinians? The Electronic Intifada co-founder and author Ali Abu Nima will join us to talk about it. All that's coming up, but first, the news from Palestine.
From the Palestine News Network, I'm Kristen S. with This Week in Review for the 7th through the 13th of November, 2008. This week we memorialized 4 years since the death of President Yasser Arafat. The Comprehensive National Dialogue, which should have ended the strife between Fatah and Hamas, fell apart after Hamas boycotted the entire event. Not only does Hamas not appreciate the Egyptian position globally or locally, the dialogue was viewed by many in the street as a capitulation to the Americans and Israelis, no matter who their governments may be. Many others issued statements of devastation, expecting that the internal, and in turn the external, situation will further deteriorate. President Abbas took the opportunity of Abu Omar's memorial in Ramallah al-Muqatta, the presidential headquarters, to denounce Hamas. Israeli forces have directly killed 11 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since last week in targeted air raids. After the first 6 people, the armed resistance began to respond with projectile launches, which the Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak used as his justification for imposing a complete closure of all crossings. No fuel came in to run the single electrical plant. Power outages raged throughout the Strip, with a complete blackout for 2 days until a trickle of fuel was able to pass. Enough to run the plant for a day, according to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. The Gaza Electric Company pinpointed the time, stating 6:30 p.m. Monday, that electricity would run out if imports continued to be banned. The moment the lights went out, thousands of people joined the Popular Committee Against the Siege in a candlelight demonstration in the center of Gaza City. The United Nations referred to the Israeli blockade as inhuman and barbaric. The UNRWA warned that it would not be able to provide food aid if imports were not allowed in. Hamdi Shakura of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza City talks about the situation after a week of closures.
We are talking about fuel for different uses, including the only plant, power plant in Gaza, which received the fuel, or the so-called industrial solar from Israel. Yesterday, they bombed some amount of industrial fuel to the power station, so now it's working. But there is a risk that the work would stop again due to continue the threat that the amount is only for 30 hours available to the plant itself. Other items, there is a real shortage in all items, whether we're talking about food, medicine, food including even flour, including the humanitarian needs for UNRWA. And this is the source why UNRWA mentioned in the media that they have only some food provisions for 1 day, and they will run out of provisions by the end of this day. Unless Israel ceases to use this kind of active punishment against the Gaza Strip, we're talking about deteriorating situation in which the only people thing that is happening is that the civilians are suffering a regime of sanctions against the whole Strip. We're talking about ongoing sanctions after election. Now we are talking about the 3rd year after elections. But the severe situation we witnessed goes back to the almost a year and a half after this collapse in the Gaza Strip and the control of Hamas to the Gaza Strip. After that, all restrictions that already existed, restrictions on the Gaza Strip, were all tightened. And since that now, we are, Gaza is on the edge of a humanitarian crisis.
Hamdi Shokota from Palestinian Center for Human Rights.
Thanks.
You're listening to This Week in Review on the Palestine News Network. For more news, see english.pnn.ps. Samed Zakout is from Rumley and is 25. For 10 years, he's been involved in bringing Arab hip-hop from its nascent stages and into the mainstream in Palestine. His band Dam is one of the most well-known in the region. He's promoting the European Palestinian hip-hop tour in the West Bank this week. One of his songs goes like this.
متذكر كله بدا عندي بالصف الثاني درس عربي لمعلمي انا امتحان فجائي فتشات على طالب اشارت علي ابدا
I remember it begins with me in the second grade. It was an Arabic lesson and the teacher said you have a sudden quiz. She searched for a student to pick and you pointed at me. Start reading. Suddenly my tongue stopped moving. I did not know what to do. I got confused. I asked the students for some rhythm and as soon as they started I started a sentence after the other. I read with my hands. I could not believe myself and I was shocked. After a complete silence, there was clapping by my classmates and even the teacher. All said this kid has a talent. Keep your eyes on him.
Samed
Zakout, tell us about the European Palestinian Hip Hop Tour.
المشروع هيب هوب بالستاين بلش عبيدي بصيف 2008 بشهر 7/8 في كل أنحاء الضفة الغربية.
The project Hip Hop Palestine started in the summer of 2008 on the 7th of August throughout the West Bank. Janine Ramallah, Bethlehem, Shuafat, Jerusalem, and Nablus. It was a summer camp for younger generations of men and women, and it was a success and a huge, complete work. So the second project, which is connected with the first one, Hip Hop Palestine, was the Palestine European Tour, which joins Palestinian people living abroad with Palestinians living inside Palestine. We will represent at several shows, four shows, at the same places that we represented at in the summer. This tour, which consists of four shows, if I am not mistaken, is considered the first rap tour that combines Palestinians from all across the world here in Palestine. The tour will start this month on November 11th in Jenin, November 12th in Nablus, and it continues the 13th of November in Ramallah. It will finish on the 14th of November in Bethlehem. What we really hope for is to send a message not only for us, but for our people and for people outside Palestine, to tell them that there are people living here, young people, as most of the Palestinians, if you count them, are young. So the message that we want to send is that here in Palestine there are humans, a culture, a case, and a people who want to live and breathe. So today, this is the best way to send a message to the whole world, with respect to our city, our culture, our music, and our art, where young men and women prefer to hear the hip-hop music. And what is really relevant to our time today is the hip-hop music, which, for those who don't know, started in America in 1978 or 1979, 30 years ago approximately. This kind of music is a way of expressing your opinion, your thoughts, and your feelings. So I am telling you, it's a huge success. If you enter any village or refugee camp or town in Palestine, you will surely find bands, someone or more, who is doing this kind of music. And there are bands who make you feel really proud and who serve the Palestinian case and send the message in a very, very beautiful way. So I somehow consider it a scream of silence, or the Palestinian hip-hop is the movement of the youngest from the boring everyday life that we live. This week, the Palestinian Authority hosted a boycott of the Israeli-controlled municipal elections in Jerusalem. Had Palestinians participated, it would have been seen as an acceptance of the annexation of the city. The mayoral candidates had promised to make life harder on the Arab citizens. The new mayor pledged today more new houses for Jews in East Jerusalem. Mais Abu Ghazala talks about the museum being built atop a Muslim cemetery and the home demolitions of the week. The Israeli Supreme Court issued a recent decision to build a museum of tolerance at the expense of the land of Mahman Allah Cemetery in West Jerusalem. This project is $200 million. According to Israeli sources, the number of graves in the cemetery until the year 1948 was 70,000. According to the Department of Islamic Endowments, the area of the cemetery is 200 acres, but now it is only 20 acres because several settlement projects were put on the land of the cemetery. Independence Park was opened, and the Plaza Hotel built on the cemetery land. A road was made and a parking lot on the cemetery land, as well as a sewage network extending inside the cemetery. Buried there are religious figures, Islamic leaders, residents, Jerusalemites. This decision, which was made by the Israeli Supreme Court, will be fought through new calls of the parents of the people who are buried there recently. Also, a massive march was planned for Thursday, which started in East Jerusalem and went to Maman Allah Cemetery. The Fatah from the Quran was read for the souls of those buried in the cemetery, and a press conference was also held. And they chanted these slogans, and people mentioned that this project was financed by America and that it is an Israeli-American project. In the conference, Mohammed Hussein, the Mufti of Jerusalem, also spoke, stressing the violations of the sanctity and the privacy of the graves. He issued a statement against those who helped in digging up those graves. The vice president of the Islamic movement, El-Sheikh Kamal al-Khatib, and the bishop, Father Asa Mesleh, have also spoken at the demonstration. Father Asa assured that both Christians and Muslims are in the same trench, and that they will defend their lands in the land of Maman Allah Cemetery, and they will not let anyone dig up the graves of the cemetery, but he assured that all the Christians will stand by the Muslims in order to defend the land. We also have to mention that there are literati buried inside the cemetery, besides Turkish and Arab soldiers like Salahuddin al-Ayyubi, in addition to Islamic scientists. At the demonstration, there were 1,500 Palestinian people, Christians, Muslims, Jerusalemites, residents, including teachers, students, and traders. It was a massive demonstration, and the Israeli authorities prevented the people from wearing the Palestinian scarf during the march. The Israelis also prevented the Chancellor of Jerusalem Affairs and the Governor of Jerusalem from delivering speeches during the conference because they represent the Palestinian government. We can notice that recently there has been an escalation in Israeli attacks on Jerusalem, and last Wednesday they destroyed a wedding hall in Beit Hanina, and Ahmed Basharat's house in Shuafat, and Badr Shweiki's house in Beit Hanina in the El Ashkariya neighborhood, in addition to three houses in the Silwan neighborhood. Many assaults took place in the Silwan neighborhood. Young men held a sit-in at their houses, and the police, the special forces, and the Israeli intelligence attacked. 52 Palestinians were wounded by Israeli bullet fire and by suffocation, and dozens of Palestinians who held sit-ins in their houses were arrested. And we know that the El Bustan neighborhood in Silwan has been a main target since the year 2000, and this attack was renewed in 2008, particularly on the eve of the Israeli municipal elections, and it's possible that this attack will increase in the next days. The march on Thursday was a protest against allowing the museum to be built on the land of the cemetery. About Allah Cemetery, the Palestinian national and political figures, Jerusalemites and residents will organize several events during the coming days in protest against the Museum of Tolerance, such as the march that was held on Thursday, and they will contact the councils and the Islamic and Arab states, specifically the Jordanian government, Egypt and Morocco, and Turkey, because there are Turkish soldiers buried in the cemetery also. The protests will continue with appeals in the Israeli Supreme Court. That was Mesa Abu Ghazala in Jerusalem. Samah Zakut leaves us with a song for the mothers. He says,
أنا الصراحة كتبت مرة أغنية وهي عن قريب إن شاء الله بدي أشتغل على إنجاز وعلى إخراج كليب لها.
I once wrote a song and I will soon work on completing it and producing a video clip for it. It's called Yamma and it's written for Palestinian mothers, especially my mother who used to cry a lot. So I'm trying to remember the chorus. It goes like this. Mother, don't be afraid. I am here. Mother to whom I can complain, who is blamed. In days some moments were destroyed. No, mother, don't cry. Kristen S. with engineers Shiraz Rajmawi and Samir Saad, Palestine News Network. For more news, see english.pnn.ps.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. On the evening of November 4th, 2008, the citizens of America elected the first African-American to the nation's highest office. Barack Hussein Obama, the president-elect, the son of a white woman from Kansas and a father from Kenya, won in a landslide election over Republican Senator John McCain that sent more than 60% of eligible voters to the polls. Media across the country and around the world showed people dancing, cheering, and weeping for joy as the 44th president and first person of color ran away with an historic election. Much of the country and the world are still in a state of euphoria over this triumph, but soon all of us will have to come back to the cold reality that the U.S. and the world economy are on shaky ground. America is bogged down in two wars that most voters want the U.S. out of. And of course, there is still the unresolved 60-plus-year issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Last summer, Obama made a whirlwind tour of the Near East and Europe. Speaking to hundreds of thousands in Berlin, Germany, Obama said, quote, "The walls between old allies on either side of the Atlantic cannot stand. The walls between countries with the most and those with the least cannot stand. The walls between races and tribes, natives and immigrants, Christians and Muslims and Jews cannot stand. These now are the walls we must tear down." Close quote. As reactions from around the world express hope for the future with an Obama presidency, in Palestine, the mood is hopeful but still cautious. So now that we are finally winding down the Bush legacy, now that we are possibly seeing the end of the neocon agenda, is there a hope that these walls that President-elect Obama speaks of, and in particular the security wall that has annexed so much Palestinian land, might come down? With us again to talk about Obama's election win, as well as the possible fate of the Palestinians under the new administration, is Crossing the Line's good friends, Kathleen and Bill Christensen. Kathleen Christensen is a former CIA political analyst and has worked on Middle East issues for over 30 years. She is the author of Perceptions of Palestine and The Wound of Dispossession. Bill Christensen was a senior official of the CIA. He served as National Intelligence Officer and as Director of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis. We welcome you both back to Crossing the Line, Kathleen and Bill Christensen.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Najee, very much.
It's a pleasure to have you both with us. Kathy, let's start with you. Can you talk about the significance of President-elect Obama's win for not only the country, but also our standing in the world today?
Well, I have mixed feelings. I don't think anybody who watched the joy on the faces of Black Americans, so many Black Americans, huge crowds, can help but feel the emotion and the historic nature of this election. You know, the first person of color, as you said, elected president of the United States. It shows that this country has come a long way in the right direction. And I felt all that, much of that emotion, too, having changed my registration 20 years ago in order to vote for Jesse Jackson. But I am really disappointed, have been disappointed and continue to be disappointed in Obama's what looks as though will be his policy on the Palestine-Israel issue, particularly, but in so many other areas as well. I do think that his election will help, at least initially, to change the United States' image around the world, which is a good thing. Our image has been just terrible, particularly over the last 8 years, but even from before, because of our policies of, attacking Muslim states and so on, which happened even before Bush came into office, but obviously Bush just escalated things immeasurably. So the knowledge around the world that the United States could elect a Black president will be a huge boost to our image, which, as I say, is a very good thing. But I think it also raises expectations quite a lot, and I think Obama needs to show right soon, right off the bat, that he can do something to put some meat behind the bones of those statements he made that you just read.
Bill, I want to ask you something. Many people, when they've been listening to the speeches that Obama has given throughout the primary season as well as heading up to the general election, they have commented saying, well, what he's saying now with respect to his AIPAC speech or other things that he has talked about, especially with foreign policy, are things that he needs to say to, quote, get elected. Given all of that, I one time asked Ali Abu Nima, who will be on the show later today, if he felt that this was the case. And Ali had said, what you say before the election is pretty much what you're going to probably have to do in order to hopefully get another term or to be able to cooperatively move on within your first term as well. Would you agree with this?
Yeah, what Ali said, in my view, is dead right on the mark. And Obama has said in his talk to AIPAC and on other occasions very strongly things totally supportive of Israel, and there are lots of little things. When he visited Israel and Palestine, he gave Palestine less than an hour of his time, or Palestinians less than an hour of his time, all the rest of his time to the Israelis. But, the problem that those of us who are saying critical things of Obama, and you will hear from us a lot of critical things. There is a serious problem here. A great, great many Americans obviously simply do not regard anything to do with Palestine as anywhere near as important as the big historical change of electing a very intelligent black person, and anything else in terms of importance just sort of fails in comparison. And I think we, all of us, have to recognize that this is a point of view not only that many people hold, but it is a perfectly legitimate point of view. But on the other hand, Kathy and I simply do not agree with it. We look at the efforts of Israel and the AIPAC and many supporters of Israel in this country of ours, the United States, and we come to the conclusion that these present policies toward the Palestinians are a serious effort to destroy an entire people, the Palestinians, and we think that is every bit as important as the historical importance of the United States having elected a black man. But you and I and Kathy and I have got to understand that a great many people in this country simply don't agree with that. We're not going to change our minds, though. We look at what is happening to Palestine and believe it is a very critical issue in the entire Muslim world, and the so-called war on terror is never going to end until justice is done to the extent that we do justice to the Israelis. The same extent of justice must be granted to the Palestinians, or the war on terror is never going to end until we do.
Can I add something there, if you're finished, Bill?
Please do.
This issue, although I think Bill is right that the majority, vast majority of the American people don't think that what happens to the Palestinians or what Israel does to the Palestinians is very important. In fact, it is a major, major issue in the world, and in terms of U.S. national interests and so on. It is because, as Bill said, it's our relationship, our partnership with Israel, is a major, plays a major role in our foreign policies. We both believe, and I think there's good evidence to show, that the U.S. went to war against Iraq largely, not entirely, but largely, to make the Middle East safe for Israel, largely for Israel's, to guarantee, help guarantee Israel's security. That is an atrocious distortion of our own national interests. Much of the war on terror is being conducted in cooperation with Israel and in large part to benefit Israel. And the Palestinian issue is very, very central, and it's very important that Americans stop being so ignorant about its centrality, because it is such a major issue in the minds of Arabs throughout the world, the Arab peoples, unfortunately not the leaders, and Muslim peoples throughout the world. I mean, they have a real legitimate grievance against the United States, because the United States is seen quite rightly to be enabling Israel's gross oppression of the Palestinians. This creates a huge negative in how we are viewed. We, the United States, are viewed around the world, and it's very, very important that we end this negative. I think this is just my personal view, but I think the best thing Obama, and the easiest thing Obama could do, is on January 21st announce that he wants an end to the embargo, the international embargo of Gaza. I think this would be a huge step in the right direction for the Gazan people and the Palestinian people, but it would also symbolically tell the world that Obama really means it when he says he has compassion for oppressed peoples, and when he says he wants to tear down the walls between peoples.
I want to go on to something, Bill, that you and I talked about the last time I had you on the show individually. We were discussing Iran and how Israel was pushing Washington to stop Iran at all costs from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Now, during the primaries, Obama said that he would meet with leaders such as Ahmadinejad, with
you know, without preconditions. But regarding Hamas, he has definitely said that they are a terrorist organization, that he will not talk with them, that he will only negotiate with more moderate groups within the Palestinian community. Now, given all of that, Hamas was democratically elected in 2006 in January. There is no dispute about that. The elections were monitored, and everyone who was monitoring said that they were fair and just. Now, paraphrasing Donald Rumsfeld, you don't go to negotiate with the government you want. You go to negotiate with the government you've got. And are we going to potentially see some kind of reciprocity that he can finally go ahead and meet with Hamas without preconditions? Just recently, they even said that they were willing to accept the state on the 67 borders, which is unprecedented for Hamas. So isn't there a chance that dialogue can happen, irrespective of whether they're labeled a terrorist organization? They were democratically elected.
There is absolutely no evidence that I've seen that Obama is prepared to change his attitudes on and policies toward Hamas at all. And this, it's a ridiculous position. You know, terrorism, what, for goodness sakes, is terrorism? It is the carrying out of violence against civilians for a political purpose. If he is against terrorism, he shouldn't be talking about the U.S. government, which is the biggest carrier out of terrorism in the entire world. Israel is close behind in the amount of terrorism it carries out against the Palestinians, with house destructions, with assassinations, with starvation of people in Gaza. Terrorism is simply a tactic of war, for goodness sakes. And this attitude of being unwilling to negotiate with Hamas comes directly from his overwhelming support, far beyond what he needed to do, in my opinion, for his electoral needs. He goes so far beyond that that it seems to me utterly impossible for him now to change in any way, at least throughout his first term. Now, if he gets elected for another term, obviously he can't be elected for a third term. It is conceivable to me that in his number two term, if he obtains a second term, it's conceivable to me that he might at that point be more willing to change. But I see absolutely not a shred of evidence that he is going to be willing to change any of his presently announced policies toward Hamas, toward the Palestinians in general. I see absolutely no evidence that he's willing to change.
Can I jump in here again for a second? I presume you're going to talk about Rahm Emanuel with Ali Abu Nima, who obviously knows him quite well, or knows of him quite well from being from Illinois. But Ali just wrote an article about Emanuel, indicating some of the or reporting on some of the moves in Congress that Emanuel made as a congressman, including that are very anti-Palestinian and pro-Israeli, including a letter that he initiated, and it was ultimately signed by, I believe, 33 senators, something like that, or possibly 33 congressmen, supporting the supporting Israel's assassination policy and terming it, a proper tactic to guarantee Israel's security. And so this, things like this and Emmanuel's policies are the first, I would say, really concrete evidence we have that Obama is not likely to change, not likely to be willing to talk to, do things like talk to Hamas and so on. But anyway, you can presumably get more on that from Ali Abu Nima. Yeah.
I'd like to get the thoughts from both of you on this next question, if I could. And Kathy, let's start with you. President Bush led from the right and often received guests from the religious right, most notably those of the Christian Zionist movement, like Reverends John Hagee and Rod Parsley. Now that Obama will assume office next January. Will we see the Christian right trying to challenge Obama on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, especially in light of the fact that so much has been made of his middle name, Hussein, for nearly the past 2 years?
Mm. I would guess that the religious right will try to keep up the pressure on him as much as it can, you know, sending letters, telegrams, protesting moves that they don't like, that they might see as not pro-Israeli enough, or things like that. I would think that he would be able to resist the pressures a little bit better than Bush did. Bush never even tried to resist the pressures. But, you know, when you have a president and his chief of staff who are already pro-Israeli and have shown themselves to be, or at least to be following policies that are anti-Palestinian, it's hard to see where they would disagree in a major way with the Christian fundamentalists of their political policies. They might indeed disagree with their religious policies and their belief, for instance, in Armageddon coming. But their political policies, which are totally supportive of Israel, really are not very different from Obama's stated policies and Rahm Emanuel's stated policies and policies that he has actually pursued.
Yeah, listen, I agree with everything Kathy has said, and one thing all of us should keep in mind, in the next, even the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we're going to get a lot more new appointments, and I think as each day passes, we will come to have a little better understanding of whether there is any real hope for change in the policies that the U.S. government pursues toward Israel, toward Iran, toward Iraq. We have really precious little evidence of the specifics of what Obama will do in the early weeks and months of his first term, which of course is the very time when I think he would have the greatest chance of making quite major changes in those policies if he wishes. All we have so far is one appointment of a chief of staff in the White House, which is it's almost a depressing event.
There is one hopeful possibility among the people being named as possibilities for Secretary of State is Chuck Hagel, the senator from Nebraska, who is a Republican, but he's very moderate as a Republican, and he has been not all that bad on Israeli Palestinian policy. This is all relative, of course, but in today's atmosphere, being not all that bad is a good thing from our standpoint and from the Palestinian standpoint. So if he, for instance, he were named as Secretary of State, he might be stand in somewhat in opposition to policies that Rahm Emanuel might enunciate and try to push. Also, on the other side, though, on the not so good side, is the influence of Dennis Ross, who used to be Clinton's chief Middle East policymaker, who is a major advisor to Obama now. And if he is named to some national security post, that would be very bad, I think, for the for those of us who stand up for Palestinian rights.
And one final question from both of you, and we'll start with Kathy. I've been watching a lot of the networks talk about Obama governing from the center, but having appointments in his cabinet that might be more center-left. Many in the pundit lands have attributed this to the fact that the newly registered voters and those under 35 years of age want to see real change, as both of you have just expressed. But are we mainly talking about domestic appointments that might be progressive, or might we see some on foreign policy as well?
I suspect it would be mostly domestic, domestic and non-economic people who might be more progressive. It looks as though all of the economic people are going to come from this lineup of people who were standing behind him at his first press conference: Paul Volcker, Rubin, and Larry Summers, and so on. On domestic social policy, I think maybe his appointments will be more progressive, and he himself may be more progressive and more, a little bit more to the left of center. I'm afraid on foreign policy that he's going to be centrist at best. You know, as I said, there's some possibility that somebody like Chuck Hagel would be appointed. He is, however, not a leftist. He's a moderate Republican, but I think you'd have to put him in the center. Dennis Ross probably considers himself a liberal, but he isn't. In fact, he's since he left the Clinton administration, he has worked with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a major outspoken supporter of right-wing Israeli government. So Ross, I think, whatever he calls himself, has shown himself to be quite right of center. And I can't really see any other foreign policy appointments that would that are likely to move Obama to the left at all, to the left. Do you, Bill?
No, I am. I've used the word depressed once before. I am really depressed. I see literally no valid evidence, hard evidence, of change in anything to do with foreign policy, and I see a lot of hopefulness. Many people we talk to have incredibly large hopes for big change in foreign policy. I hope they're right, but until there is some evidence that they are right, I'm going to stay depressed.
Thank you so much, and we're going to leave it there. We've been speaking with our good friends Kathleen and Bill Christensen. Kathleen Christensen is a former CIA political analyst and has worked on Middle East issues for 30 years. She is the author of two books, Perceptions of Palestine and The Wound of Dispossession. Bill Christensen was a senior officer of the CIA. He served as a national intelligence officer and as director of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis.
By the way, we have another book that is coming out.
Ah, you do? Well, we're going to have you back on the show and look over that one pretty soon. I'm very excited to hear about that.
Probably next summer.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, Kathy and Bill, as always, it's a pleasure, and thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you very
much. Thanks for having us.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. Throughout the nearly two-year campaign of President-elect Barack Obama, the slogan that many remember is, "Change you can believe in." At the annual AIPAC conference held in Washington, D.C. last June, Obama told the assembled audience that Jerusalem would be the undivided capital of Israel. Many who advocate for Palestinian self-determination became quite concerned with this statement. But others tried to soothe their concerns by saying that Obama will be more even-handed towards the Palestinians. However, many progressives fear that the 44th president-elect will travel the same path as his predecessor when Obama picked Rahm Israel Emanuel as his chief of staff. Emanuel is considered extremely pro-Israel and has been a strong supporter of the continued occupation of Palestinian lands. So what change, if any, will we see in the new administration with respects to the Palestinians? With us to talk about the appointment of Emanuel is Ali Abu Nima, the co-founder of Electronic Intifada and the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali Abu Nima, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Thank you, Najee.
Ali, Rahm Emanuel is Obama's first high-level appointment in his administration. Can you talk a bit about whom Emanuel is and his background?
Yes. Rahm Emanuel is a member of Congress, a representative from the north side of Chicago. He previously worked in the White House under the Clinton administration, and he, between working in the White House and being elected to Congress in 2002, he was an investment banker. During the 2006 elections, midterm elections. He was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and did his best to ensure that pro-war Democrats were elected. He's also one of the Democrats who receives the highest number of campaign contributions from investment banks and from financial firms. So he is a fairly right-wing Democrat who is associated during the Clinton administration with some of the neoliberal reforms of the Clinton administration, so-called welfare reform, pushing through NAFTA and other free trade agreements and so on. He has a particularly hardline pro-Israel record, in many cases, even to the right of the Bush administration. In 2003, for example, he co-signed a letter with a number of other leading Democrats, including the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, criticizing the Bush administration for being insufficiently supportive of Israel. In particular, they were supporting Israel's right, as they called it, to carry out the assassinations of Palestinian political leaders, which, of course, are illegal extrajudicial executions. And in 2003, more Palestinian civilian bystanders were killed in these assassinations than the actual targets of the assassination. So that's one example of where Emmanuel has been even more pro-Israel than the Bush administration.
Now, Ali, his father is originally an Israeli. He was born in Israel and I believe immigrated here to the United States. I believe his mother is a Jewish American. In fact, when Rahm Emanuel was younger, did he not volunteer to help out the effort with the then occupation of Lebanon for the Israeli army?
Yes, I mean, the Emanuel family history is interesting and actually came up in the past few days, became quite relevant. Rahm Emanuel is the son of Dr. Benjamin Emanuel, who is a pediatrician here in Chicago, but who emigrated from Israel in the 1950s and was born in Jerusalem. Obviously, it wasn't Israel when he was born. It was Palestine. Excuse me. Emmanuel was a member, Benjamin Emmanuel, the father, was a member of the Irgun. This is the pre-state Israeli militia or Jewish militia that carried out numerous terrorist attacks on Palestinians. It had a role in the Deir Yassin massacre and many other massacres of Palestinians. The bombing of the King David Hotel in 1946. And Emmanuel was part of the Irgun. Some reports have said that he was involved in smuggling weapons into Palestine for the Irgun. Just a few days after the appointment of his son as chief of staff, Emmanuel was in the news because he made very disparaging anti-Arab remarks, saying to an Israeli newspaper in Hebrew his son would influence President Obama to be pro-Israel because, you know, he's not an Arab and he's not going to be in the White House to sweep the floors. After an outcry from Arab Americans, Rahm Emanuel has apologized for those remarks. As for Rahm himself, in 1991, he served... It's not exactly clear, but as best as I can make out, he served as a civilian volunteer during the first Gulf War to help the Israeli army maintain vehicles, military vehicles on the border with Lebanon. Yes, it's true that Israel was occupying southern Lebanon at the time. I think a relevant question would be, that was a period when the United States was at war. Why Emmanuel volunteered for serving in Israel rather than volunteering for the United States Armed Forces? That's a question I think that would have been put to him had he, had circumstances been different. But I don't know that he's ever been asked that question.
Ali, in the past, I've had you on the show, and we've spoken about Obama's relationship with the Palestinian community in Chicago, which, of course, you said that you've been active in your years of living there. He had a relationship with the late Palestinian intellectual Edward Said, and during the campaign, McCain and Palin tried to show some sort of dangerous link between himself and Rashid Khalidi, who is a professor at Columbia University. Now, given all of this, wouldn't Emmanuel have been hesitant to take up such a post with someone with these ties? I remember before he had accepted this appointment, he felt that he needed to know a little bit more about Obama. Have those fears been soothed, do you think?
Yes. I mean, the links that Obama had to the Palestinian community have been greatly overblown. And in fact, since before Obama was elected to the Senate, he has been moving very steadily and firmly into a quite hardline pro-Israel camp. And if you look at his policy statements in speeches he made to AIPAC in March 2007 and in June 2008, you see that they're consistent with a pro-Israel hardline position that is remarkable only with its conformity with the positions taken by the current administration or the Clinton administration. So I think Emmanuel can feel very comfortable knowing that he's going to serve in an administration that is not going to deviate from the pro-Israel consensus that has dominated in Washington.
You wrote in an article on Electronic Intifada the day after the election that, quote, Emmanuel has sometimes posed as a defender of Palestinian lives, though never from the constant Israeli violence that is responsible for the vast majority of deaths and injuries. On 14 June 2007, he wrote to U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, quote, on behalf of students in the Gaza Strip whose future is threatened by the ongoing fighting there, which he blamed on the violence and militancy of their elders. First of all, Ali, can you talk a bit about this letter and how the Palestinians viewed the solution that he proposed?
Yeah, the letter came at the time when, and it was written with one other representative, former Illinois Republican, Rayla Hood. The letter was directed to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and came at just about the time when Hamas had taken over the interior of the Gaza Strip from the U.S. and Israeli-backed militias loyal to Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And several hundred Palestinians had been killed in this kind of internal fighting. And so Emmanuel, of course, it was taking part at the time when Palestinian students sit for their annual exams. And Emmanuel wrote this letter saying, you know, how terrible, you know, that Palestinian students cannot study, cannot do their exams because of, you know, this awful fighting. And, you know, let's try and take them out of Gaza so that they can sit for their exams in peace and quiet. I mean, there's a couple of problems with this, of course. First of all, the educations of Palestinian children and young people were disrupted by that fighting, but their educations have been disrupted for years and far more intensively by the Israeli occupation and violence, and Emmanuel has never mentioned that. He never said anything, for example, when recently Israel refused to allow several students from Gaza who had received Fulbright scholarships, and Israel refused to allow them to leave Gaza to travel to the United States. The other problem, of course, is that for Palestinians, any quote-unquote solution which removes them from the country is very, very unwelcome because, of course, there's no guarantee that Israel would allow them back in. And there are in Israel political parties who openly call for what they call the transfer of Palestinians, getting Palestinians out of the country to reduce their population, particularly younger Palestinians of reproductive age. So I'm not saying that Rahm Emanuel was suggesting that, and nor did his letter suggest removing them permanently. I'm simply saying that many Palestinians would have those fears at the back of their head when they hear such a thing.
Well, have you heard any reports since after Obama won the election with respect to Palestinians in Palestine. And I know that they had greater joy with this election, but although they're still cautious, has that caution now really been affirmed to saying that we're now strictly in the same pattern as before with the selection of Emmanuel? Have you spoken with any Palestinians within the country who are now feeling that maybe the honeymoon is officially over, that we're pretty much back to business as usual?
I think that the Emmanuel appointment and the subsequent comments were of his father were a bucket of cold water over a lot of the euphoria. And the euphoria was not universally shared, but there was quite a lot of it. And I think that this has brought people back down to earth. And I think that, for example, the Hamas leadership have hoped that the Obama administration would be more accommodating, more willing to talk to them than the Bush administration, and have tried to make some overtures towards Obama, as Iran has, by sending a congratulatory letter. But I think that they're going to be disappointed by the response.
Earlier in the show, I had Bill and Kathleen Christensen on speaking about the Obama presidency. And one of the questions that I posed to Bill Christensen was with respects to Iran. And Obama's statement during, especially in the debates, of saying that he would meet with someone like, say, Ahmadinejad without preconditions in order to talk with them. And of course, he was lambasted for this, saying that you can't do that. You know, you have to go ahead and set up certain parameters. However, no mention of this has ever been made to the democratically elected government of the Palestinians, which is Hamas, which he has constantly labeled a terrorist organization. And in fact, that he wrote a letter to UN Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, stating that, you know, Hamas was a terrorist organization and that Israel did have a right to defend itself. My question to you is, why not also have the same conditions set out for Hamas as he has with Ahmadinejad?
Well, that's a question I can't answer. It does show that there is an inconsistency in policy, and that the policy is probably driven by political considerations rather than sound logic of how to approach these things. It's interesting that Obama has been consistently against including Hamas and seeing it transform into a political party. He opposed the Palestinian elections that took place in January 2006, with Hamas being allowed to take part. So he's been quite consistent and consistent in calling for Hamas to remain isolated. So I would have to say that again indicates that we're not going to see very much change from the Bush administration.
Another question I wanted to pose to you, and this is something I've been thinking about over the last week or so, is during the course of his election campaign, there was that incident of two women wearing the hijab who were both pulled aside and asked not to be within the shot as Obama was speaking. This created a rightfully justified outrage from the Muslim community, of which you and I are both a part. And later, the Obama camp had apologized for this incident. Are we going to possibly see more pushing from, say, someone like Keith Ellison with respect for not only Muslims, but in particular Palestinian Muslims, whose very site, which is, of course, the third most holiest site in all of Islam, is the Dome of the Rock, being threatened? Do we see Ellison trying to push this administration towards being more even-handed, especially with regards to the issues concerning those of us within our faith?
Well, what was really charged, not shocking, I'm not surprised about it, but horrifying nonetheless about the campaign, was how much open anti-Arab and anti-Muslim incitement there was. By the McCain campaign, of course, by other right-wing groups not officially affiliated with the McCain campaign, a tremendous amount of hate on the internet directed against Arabs and Muslims. The Obama campaign did nothing to respond to this in an appropriate way. They never stood up and defended the Arab and Muslim communities against this kind of incitement and hatred. Their concern was to defend Obama from being associated with Arabs and Muslims. So they were very much playing into the anti-Muslim and anti-Arab incitement. The incident with the two young women is one example of how they played into the hatred rather than confronted it. And, of course, the comments by Benjamin Emanuel show the kind of open incitement against Arabs that is possible now in this country. What has been quite shocking is the lack of response. It's very hard to imagine another group against which such a storm of hatred could be directed, where there would be such silence from, you know, right-thinking liberal people, from the editorial pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the other leading papers. The only significant national figure who actually took this on directly was, ironically, a Republican, General Colin Powell, who spoke out against it. So I have been very disappointed with the lack of response from members of Congress and senators, and I fear that there are going to be many people who now simply will not want to challenge the Obama administration or stand up on these issues. I think we also have to remember that it's more than just tokenism. I mean, even the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before it would hold, you know, an annual Ramadan iftar and things like that. But we have to go beyond that kind of tokenism towards policies that end the dehumanization of Arabs and Muslims at home and around the world. And that's a much bigger challenge for all of us.
Recently, the website WaynesMasdenReport.com reported that the U.S. intelligence sources said that Emanuel has an active FBI counterintelligence file. In fact, questioned about Emanuel's links to the Israeli intelligence agency, or the Mossad, were allegedly so great that then-President Clinton had to dismiss Emanuel from his staff in 1998. Ali Abinima, your thoughts on this?
Well, I saw that report, but I didn't really think the sources were sufficiently substantiated. So it's I really don't think that there's much more to say about it. I don't... I mean, there's no independent confirmation of those things. But what's not in doubt is the open identification that Rahm Emanuel has had with the State of Israel, and the fact that he chose to volunteer to defend Israel rather than in the United States Armed Forces at the time when the United States was at war, I think is something that, you know, many of us, his father was an Israeli, I'm a Palestinian American. Many of us have ties to other parts of the world, and that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. But I think that people ought to be held to the same standard. And I think that it would be very difficult for a Palestinian American, impossible for a Palestinian American, all other things being equal, to be in the position Rahm Emanuel is in today. And that kind of has to make us ask, what are some of the assumptions behind American policy, and who is entitled to take part in the political system and who isn't? And that goes for many, many other political groups, ethnic and other community groups in this country, who are systematically excluded from the circles of power in this country. And I'm not very confident that simply electing Obama will change that. And I think that the lesson for all of us is that really the struggle starts now. A lot of people think electing Obama, the job was done. Actually, I think that's, if anything, only a beginning.
And we are going to leave it there. Our guest has been Ali Abunima, co-founder and editor of Electronic Intifada and the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. And remember to check out the EI website, which publishes news, commentary, analysis, and reference materials about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict from a Palestinian perspective. Ali Abunima, as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us, and thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line,
which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer George Ushmawi, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Najee Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.